Hello, junkies. Welcome to episode number 13 of the Nocturnal Throwback Podcast. I hope that you are staying safe. I hope that you are staying smart. We here at Empty Set Entertainment are trying to entertain your face. How? Not just this glorious hop into the Wayback Machine to carry you away to 2007, when I was podcasting the first draft of Nocturnal, released weekly episodes as I wrote them. No, not just that. And not just Story Smack, with a new episode coming out soon about The Platform, a bizarro horror movie on Netflix. And not just that. No, we are also now doing Sigler in Place and Facebook Live every Tuesday and Thursday. You can remember, it's the days that start with a T. A Real Girl and I are doing what amounts to an hour of live television. On the Facebook Live, we are reading you stories. We are showing you artifacts gathered from 15 years of fan interaction. We are answering junkie questions, and there is more stuff. It's fun. It's sometimes funny. And it is the opposite of the depressing news you see on TV these days. You should join us at facebook.com/Scott Sigler. Go there, follow the page, keep your eyes open there on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We go live at 6 p.m. Pacific time every Tuesday and Thursday. There's a ton of junkies in the chat room hanging out. You may see some familiar faces if you have been to Sigler events, if you've been to a Sigler fest. If you haven't, this is a very welcoming bunch of people, and they would love to see you there. And if you play your cards right, every now and then, you get to lay eyes on the Dogs of Doom, who are often on the cast with us. We're trying to bring the fun into all of this in the midst of all this yuckiness. So go there, follow us, join us. We'll see you on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 6 p.m. Pacific. And now, let's get on with Nocturnal Throwback, episode number 13. Welcome to the podcast novel Nocturnal, episode number 13. If you just found this because of coverage on AMCTV.com or Death Ray Magazine, start with episode 1.
Nocturnal is a podcast-only novel you can't buy in stores and you can't peek at the end. Written and performed by Scott Sigler. More information and more free stories at scottsigler.com. This book contains adult language, mature situations, and lots of violence.
Hello there, junkies. I've got a big, fat 30-minute episode for you, so no beating around the bush. I'll just tease you with what's coming up after the episode. We're going to talk about the ridiculous price for advanced reader copies of Infected on eBay and why you should not spend your money on that. Talk about some sweet media coverage J.C. Hutchins and I got in Death Ray Magazine. I've got a few promos for you, and I'll tell you all about the horrific experience recording the Infected audiobook, which is now done. But enough of that crap. For those of you who have been with me for a long time, let's bring back a familiar voice for the story so far.
And now, another exciting episode of Big Space!
Or BS for short.
Cryogenic wake-up procedure initiated.
Otto, coffee.
Insufficient supplies. No coffee.
Great. Otto, vodka.
Insufficient supplies. No vodka.
What?
Don't you remember? You're currently on board an escape pod, lost in deep space. I put you into a cryogenic sleep to increase your chances of survival until rescued.
Ah, crap. I was hoping that was kind of a dream or something.
And I was hoping your breath wouldn't smell so bad. My olfactory sensors are about to crash.
Yeah, it's my natural scent. Wait, why'd you wake me up then? Is there a rescue ship? Am I about to be saved?
No.
Oh, then why did you wake me up?
Because it's time to introduce Scott Sigler's Nocturnal, the story so far, introduction.
Nocturnal? Oh boy, that's my favorite! Why, I remember watching the holographic of Nocturnal when I was this tall. Kidnaps, murders, baby eating.
You've got to love the classics.
Good times, good times. So, which chapter are we up to?
13.
13, oh, that's a good one. Okay, here we go. And now, the story so far. A series of missing persons and brutal murders has ripped through San Francisco. All the crimes tied together by a series of strange symbols. Medical examiner Robin Hudson examined four of the corpses and through DNA analysis of saliva learned that two of the killers were brothers, as was one of the victims. She shared that strange family connection with Detectives Pookie Chang and Brian Closser, Robin's ex-boyfriend. The symbols connected this...
Rescue ship detected in communication range.
Hey, hey! I'm in the middle of a story so far over here!
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Now, where was I? Oh yeah, the symbols, okay. The symbols connected this string of murders to an old serial killer case from the early 80s, that'd be the 1980s, the Golden Gate Park Slasher. Pookie's analysis of police files of the slasher showed missing crime scene reports. Someone had removed information. It's a cover-up, but Pookie doesn't know what exactly is being covered up. In his search, Pookie learns two key things. The first is that retired SFPD detective Francis Parkmeyer was the lead investigator in the slasher case. The second, that Parkmeyer's junior partner on the case was none other than current San Francisco Police Chief Amy Zoe. Pookie and Brian decide to pay Parkmeyer a visit, but before they can, they're summoned by that same Chief Zoe. Coinkydink? Methinks not. She wants to see both of them immediately.
Well done, Ruckus.
Thank you, Otto. Hey, did you say something about a rescue ship?
It's no longer in communication range now. Initiating cryogenics lead.
Son of a...
Another exciting episode of Big Space is coming soon to a podcast near you.
After she let Pookie out, Maggie O'Donnell sat at her desk. She used her janitor-sized keyring to open the bottom right drawer and pull out a cell phone. She looked around to make sure no one was in earshot. Then she dialed. A woman answered on the second ring.
Chief So here.
Chief, it's Maggie O'Donnell.
There was a pause.
Go ahead.
Pookie Chang was just here, going through the Grand Park slasher files.
Did he find anything?
No, but he knows information is missing. He seemed to be looking for something specific, but didn't find it.
Good. He may come back again, looking at other cases.
Maggie nodded as she talked.
And I've removed everything you specified. There's nothing to find.
Thank you, Maggie. Let me know.
Of course,
Maggie said, and hung up. She put the cell phone back in the drawer, locked it, then stood and walked out of the records room. She marched right upstairs, out of the Hall of Justice, and walked 3 blocks to her car. The whole time, her body remained rigid and her face a sheet of emotionless stone. Maggie reached her car, sat inside, shut and locked the doors. She gripped the steering wheel and stared straight out. She didn't like to think about the Golden Gate Park slasher. Most days, she managed to block it out. And when she did think about it, she pushed the thoughts away with a discipline formed over the past 30 years. But Pookie Chang coming in, digging through the files, talking about it. It was too much to block out. A single tear dripped down Maggie's left cheek. It was a harbinger, for seconds later, she laid her head on her arms, her body convulsing with deep, desperate sobs. This time, Pookie seemed fresh and rested, while Brian dragged his tired ass into the precinct. Pookie had landed 5 hours of actual sleep, which was a bumper crop in the current situation, while Brian had been up all night, staking out the Erickson house. At the time he should have been crawling into bed, he'd been called to Chief Zoe's office. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Get thine ass to the head honcho's office ASAP. The annoying sun was well past dawn, just high enough in the sky to blare through Chief Lynn's window and right into his face. Brian slumped into one of the 2 chairs in front of the chief's desk. Chief Zoe looked as neat and pressed as ever. She didn't look happy, but she never looked happy. In fact, Chief Zoe looked like she always looked, like she was constipated and hadn't been laid in 3 years. Pookie seemed to soak up the sun as he rolled into the chief's office, just a few steps behind Brian. He started to sit when Zoe stopped him.
Shut the door, detective.
Pookie kind of half froze in mid-sit. He looked at Chief Zoe, then looked at Brian. Brian recognized the expression, the one that said, "Oh shit, what did we do now?" He recognized it and probably wore the same expression himself.
Do you need Detective Clouser's permission to do what I say, Detective Chang? No, ma'am. Then shut the goddamn door.
Pookie stood and walked to the door. It shut with a nasty screech, hinges that were rarely used bitching up a storm at finally being called into action. Pookie just stood there.
Do you want to sit down, Detective Chang? Should I ask Detective Clouset for permission first?
Lin's eyes narrowed.
You're funny, Pookie, and I like you because you're funny. But do I look like I'm in the mood for humor right now?
No, ma'am.
Then sit your ass down, and no more jokes.
Pookie sat. Chief Zoe stood. She paced. She still looked like she needed to get laid.
You two have been digging into the Grand Park slasher case. Why are you wasting your time on a case that's been closed for decades?
Pookie said nothing. Brian finally spoke.
We think it might be related to the Alex Panos case.
Zoe stopped pacing and stared at him.
How can it be related when the Grand Park slasher is long dead?
We think they may be connected.
And why do you think that?
Her tone was low, cold, and quiet. There was something in her voice that hinted at malice. Pookie sat straight up and rubbed at his chin. Brian caught the signal. They had several signals they'd developed over the years. Little things that let them be on the same page in front of witnesses, perps, other cops, or even, in this case, the chief of the San Francisco Police Department. The rubbing of the chin said, "Shut the fuck up and let me handle this. I know what I'm doing."
I said, "Detective Chang, why do you think they are connected?"
I remember an article I saw about the case. It said the slasher was killed by an arrow. Marco Gastineau was killed by an arrow. So we're looking for a connection.
And where did you see this article?
Pookie shrugged.
A long time ago I saw it. It just stuck in my head is all.
Chief Zoe nodded. She was damn good at hiding her emotions, but Brian could see that was a nod people make when they think the sentence they just heard is total bullshit.
And what have you found so far?
Pookie shrugged.
I looked up the slasher files and archives, but I couldn't find anything about an arrow. Either most of the information is missing, or Alzheimer's is setting in early, and I imagined the whole arrow thing.
Well, those files are old. Who knows where they've been?
Who knows?
And what else have you two found?
Brian said nothing, choosing to follow Pookie's lead.
Not that much. Sometimes information just isn't there.
Sometimes. Is there anything else that you two want to tell me?
Pookie rubbed his chin.
Nothing else you're forgetting. How about the symbols you guys are looking up?
Pookie looked at Brian before answering.
There were symbols at the Pano scene, Chief. We're just following up on them.
And the symbols on the arrowhead that killed Marco Gastineau.
Oh, yeah. I guess that slipped my mind.
And at the scenes of Paul Fisher's death,
Brian said, his tone short and harsh.
And outside the window of the missing J. Parlar. I think that merits investigation, and I think you'd agree.
He was only going to take so much of this bullshit. Pookie rubbed at his chin some more.
And have you found anything? Anything with the symbols?
Brian shook his head. It sickened him, but he had to keep up his end of the charade.
Nothing, Chief. Big mystery at this point.
Pookie smiled.
What do you think, Chief Zoe? Do you have any theories on all this crazy stuff?
She stared at him for a good 10 seconds before answering. Long enough for Brian to feel even more uncomfortable than he already was. Long enough for Pookie's smile to gradually fade away.
I think you're wasting the taxpayers' time, and I don't like it when my people waste taxpayers' time. In fact, I want you to drop this whole slasher angle. There's no connection. I was on the force when that went down, and I've read the Panos file, and there is no connection.
Zoe was telling them to back off, but that didn't make any sense. Brian leaned forward.
Come on, Chief. Why wouldn't we follow up on every possible lead?
She turned her hard stare on him. Another 10 seconds. Brian wanted to crawl out of his skin. She finally spoke when he looked away.
Because I told you, it's a waste of time. Let it go. No more with the slasher case, you understand? And I don't want any more research into these symbols. It's random graffiti from a psycho.
Two clear leads, and the chief of police wanted them to back off. For the first time, Brian really, really believed Mr. Biznas, and he was glad they'd kept the man's name out of any reports.
Sure, Chief,
Pookie said cheerfully.
You're the boss, right?
Zoe nodded.
Yeah, whatever you say goes, right?
Zoe nodded again.
Good. You're the big kahuna, A1, top of the heap.
Knock it off, Pookie. What did I tell you about being funny?
Pookie said nothing, and the office filled with silence. Chief Zoe leaned forward.
Just trust me on this, guys. Trust me. This'll all be over soon.
It was only half a command. Her voice gave the order, but her eyes were genuinely asking them.
That all, Chief?
Pookie said, that same fake smile still plastered on his face. She sat back, her eyes narrowed, the asking expression gone, the stone face back in place.
Yes, that's all.
Pookie and Brian left the office without another word. They drove straight to the Sushi Rock restaurant at Polk and Sacramento. Pookie filled Brian in on the Golden Gate Slasher case files, particularly the teensy little fact that showed Chief Amy Zoe, then Detective Amy Zoe, had been on the case. Once at the restaurant, Pookie ordered 2 cohibito rolls, the house specialty. Brian ordered 32 pieces of tuna sashimi. When the waiter left, Pookie finally spoke.
That was some pretty fucked up shit right there.
Brian nodded. Yeah, that it was.
She's telling us to back off. There's a clear connection here. People are dying left and right, and she wants us to back off? What the fuck for?
Brian took a drink from his Sapporo. He was off duty, while Pookie had to settle for tea.
I'm starting to think Mr. Biznass was right.
You're just starting to think? That's like saying Tom Brady is just starting to get the hang of some game they call football. Welcome to the party, pal.
Pookie started ticking off points on his fingers.
First, the Golden Gate Park slasher file is missing information. Key information. Like all references to a silver arrow. Second, she knows I was looking at that file. I didn't report that or write it down anywhere, so someone had to tell her.
Which means she's been prepared for this. She has a warning system in place.
Right. Now you're catching on, little camper. But don't order yet, because there's more. Third, she knew I was looking into the arrowhead symbols. Again, I didn't put that in any reports yet. The only one who knew I was looking was Black Mr. Burns, and he wouldn't have filed the report because we didn't find squat.
Do you think maybe Black Mr. Burns told her?
Pookie shook his head.
No, I don't. He didn't act suspicious or concerned in the least. I also think it was the first time he'd seen those symbols. No tells of recognition when he saw them, you know what I mean?
And we know that the same symbols connect Panos with the slasher.
Yeah, Panos dies with the first 2 symbols written in his blood. Then Solar dies. Same symbols at the scene, Gastineau at the scene. Gastineau dies from an arrowhead that has 2 more symbols. The 2 sets of symbols are totally linked, and the arrowhead is linked to the slasher case. The connection is so tight, you couldn't slip a mosquito cock between them.
That's pretty tight.
Hell yes it is. And if we know the symbols are all connected, she knows, because she was on the Golden fucking Gate slasher case. Am I right?
You're right.
So there's a clear connection here. It's a slam dunk, and she wants us to back off.
Why? Why would Zoe want us to back off a multiple homicide? She's as straight up gets.
That's what I thought, too. But maybe we have to rethink that, Bri.
Their food came. Pookie had to move his overstuffed manila folder to the back edge of the table to make room. His cohibito rolls were spaced out, 16 pieces in a big X on a curved white platter. Shrimp tempura, wrapped in rice, and covered with shredded crab and little red tobiko. Brian's platter, on the other hand, looked exactly like what it was, a big pile of raw flesh. The cooks presented it well, with a bed of big green lettuce leaves and 4 orange garnishes, but there's only so much you can do to dress up 2 pounds of ruby red fish. Brian ate 4 pieces before he spoke, the firm tuna melting in his mouth.
I'm not backing off, Pooks.
What? And you think I am?
2 pieces of cohibito roll slurred Pookie's words. He pointed to himself with his chopsticks as he spoke, and a little bit of crab flew from his mouth to land on the table.
Ah, that's like a little loony sandwich.
Brian knew the phrase, one of Pookie's favorites. I'm on this like a bum on a bologna sandwich.
We could get fired,
Brian said. Pookie's head leaned back, moving side to side a little like Stevie Wonder, and his face wrinkled into a dismissive expression.
He waved his chopstick-holding hand in front of him. He talked as he worked to chew through the food.
Oh, fuck that,
he said. Chew, swallow.
There's no way I can let this go.
Chew, swallow. He licked his lips, mouth finally clear.
No way. There's something big going on here with the Savior and the Nocturnals and the fucking Mutie Zedgenes and all them shits. Zoe is up to no good, man, and we gotta figure this out.
He stabbed another piece and popped it into his mouth.
I don't think she's up to no good.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Pookie hissed around his mouthful of food.
She's a bad cop, Bri. A bad cop at the highest possible level.
But I just didn't get that vibe. There's something else going on here.
You're crazy!
Another shred of crab flew out of Pookie's mouth and landed on the table.
I don't know why I feel that way. And chew with your mouth closed, will ya? She was on the slasher case, right? That had to be when she was, like, really young.
Youngest cop to make detective in SFPD history.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. So she's on the case, but at best, she's the junior to Francis Parkmeyer.
That's right. The same man who is also responsible for the release of Jebediah Erickson from a jail where they lock up serial killers and throw away the key.
Brian nodded slowly.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got to be what now, in his late 60s? Early 70s?
Pookie stopped chewing. He set his chopsticks down and started flipping through his manila folder. His finger stabbed a name he jotted down on the inside back cover.
Francis Parkmeyer,
Pookie said, and looked up.
Looks like he'd be 72.
He'd be retired,
Brian said.
Let's find out if he's still kicking, then go pay our respects.
I tell you what, Brian, I'm investing in Depends.
In what?
Depends. You know, adult diapers.
Why?
Look around you, man. Look at all these people wearing diapers. And the baby boomers are getting old. They're retiring. You get it? Do you dig it? That's millions of people gearing up to shit themselves on a daily basis. It's a goldmine of a stock, I tell you.
San Francisco assisted living was not what Brian would describe as a happy place. Sure, everyone seemed to be in decent spirits, offering smiles. But more often than not, those smiles were vacant of thought. The easy smile of a toddler, plastered on the wrinkled face of an octogenarian. San Francisco assisted living was where people came to live out their last few years. In comfort, mind you, with the staff taking care of their needs and occasional visits from their families, if they had any family left. Francis Parkmeyer did not. Brian and Pookie walked down the hall, led by a middle-aged man named Chuck Baker. Chuck ran the place. He was one of those guys with a key ring so loaded up it pulled his pants down a bit on his left-hand side. When Brian and Pookie showed up and flashed their badges, asking to speak to Detective Francis Parkmeyer, retired, the staff immediately called Chuck. Chuck looked like an average guy. Average height, average build, average looks. Average all around, save for a hairline that was only receding on the left-hand side. And that was weird enough that it was hard to look away when you talked to him.
Has Mr. Parkmeyer done something wrong? Chuck asked.
No, nothing like that. We just need to talk to him about a case he once investigated.
Chuck seemed relieved.
Well, that's good to hear. He's a great old guy. He'll be thrilled to talk to someone from the police department. He loves to talk about his career. At least when he can remember what his career was.
Chuck stopped at room 113. He knocked.
Mr. Parkmeyer?
No answer.
Mr. Parkmeyer, are you in there?
After a pause, he pulled out his thick keyring.
I'm coming in now, Mr. Parkmeyer.
He opened the door, peeked his head inside, then slowly walked in. Brian and Pookie followed. Francis Parkmeyer sat in a chair, staring out the window onto Van Ness Street. He'd been a big man in his day, but now had the slumped shoulders and hunched back of a man well past his prime. Wrinkled skin sagged from his face. He wore a blue, button-down sweater over a white shirt, tan slacks, and loafers. An official grandpa uniform if Brian had ever seen one. The small, one-room apartment was far from the sterile hospital room that Brian had expected. Clean brown carpet ran to the cream-colored walls that even had white crown molding. Pictures covered the walls. Old shots of a young Parkmeyer in uniform. Family shots. Some ancient black and whites that had to be his mom and dad. A thick blue comforter covered a tidy bed, next to which sat a nightstand with a lamp and a phone. a novel titled Moravi, sat on the nightstand. He had a TV that faced a couch and the chair in which he sat, and a packed bookshelf that covered one wall. The window facing Van Ness filled the room with light. One door obviously led to a bathroom. Home sweet home. Chuck walked up to Parkmeyer and gently touched him on the shoulder.
Mr. Parkmeyer?
The old man looked up for a second. Then his head sagged to the side, and a thin stream of drool escaped the right corner of his mouth. Chuck Baker was faster than an Old West gunfighter, automatically whipping a clean towel from his back pocket and cleaning up the mess before the drool could even land on Parkmeyer's sweater.
I'm sorry, detectives, Baker said. Mr. Parkmeyer isn't really in a state to answer your questions right now.
How long will he be out of it?
Brian asked.
It's not a matter of how long he'll be out of it, more like how long he'll be in it when he's in it at all. Mr. Parkmeyer has more bad days than good, I'm afraid, and it's only getting worse.
Pookie handed Baker a business card.
Can you call us if he reaches a state where he can talk? We'll come right away.
Baker took the card and nodded.
Of course, detectives.
Brian and Pookie left assisted living. They had to slowly pass a few elderly people walking, shambling, or rolling down the hallways.
Depends, Bri, Pookie said quietly. I'm telling you, a gold mine.
So now what? Brian asked. Want to head over and check out those files that Kyle Soler left for us?
Pookie checked his watch.
That's a good idea. School is letting out right about now, so most of the kids will be gone by the time we get there. We can bring a sixer and read and chill.
You can't bring a sixer into a high school, Pooks.
What? Has the educational system changed so much since I was a student? I used to come to school with half a sixer ingested and the remainder stashed in my locker.
The remainder? What are you, some kind of math nerd or something?
That's called division, Bri. 6 minus 3 equals 3 plus the ability to get through history class. All right, Spoilsport. I won't bring any beer to the principal's office. Let's go get some quick dinner, then head over to Galileo. We're due for a break in this fucking case. Maybe Solar's files will be just the thing.
Rex DeProvdichuk walked down the hallways of Galileo High School. Not the sides, not slinking around the edges of the hall, head hung, shoulders shrugged to his ears, hoping no one would see, wishing he was invisible. No, not anymore. Rex walked down the hall, down the middle of the hall, then out the front door. He would take the basic path home. He didn't have to walk 10 blocks out of his way. He didn't have to skulk because he wasn't looking out for Boyko anymore. He wasn't afraid to walk home because Boy's company was gone. And Rex's head wasn't hung low, all shrugged in his shoulders like a dog about to be hit, eyes on the ground. His head was straight up, and he looked everyone right in the eye. He didn't have to look down anymore because he had power. The power over life and death. The power of a god. Rex didn't understand it, didn't understand why, didn't understand how it worked. But he did understand one thing. The people he hated went away. They were slaughtered, or they vanished. All of Boyko, gone. That prick principal Kyle Soler, murdered. Stacy Telling, the teacher that made him talk in front of the class, made him stand up in front of everyone, made him stammer and stutter. She was missing. Robert Wicks, the science teacher, the one who had once dragged him to the principal's office for no reason, dragged him down the hall while the other kids snickered and laughed. Wicks was missing, his family missing, except for his son, Chris. Chris, who had once given Rex a Grundy right in the hall. Chris had it coming, and now Chris was dead. Dead because Rex hated him. And that dude with the I Will Comply shirt, Rex had put him down. And that bum, Rex had made him bleed. He did it, Rex, with his own hands. Rex walked down the middle of the hall. People didn't exactly get out of his way, but they weren't knocking him around either. Did all the other kids know? Did they know that Rex DeProvdichuk could wish them dead? Did they know that if he drew their picture, they were doomed? Maybe tonight he'd draw some more people. Maybe he'd draw his stepmother, Roberta. But he had to be careful about that. It was Roberta's house. He'd love to see her gone, but then what would happen? Where would he go? How would he get food? He had to think. All the greats, they all use strategy. Like Kaiser Sose from The Usual Suspects. No one even knew who he was. He kept it quiet, but he was the deadliest gangster in the world. Much better than Jack Nicholson's character in The Departed, Frank Costello. That guy knew how to get things done, but he was all crazy and into drugs. That wasn't the way to do things. Michael Corleone from the Godfather movies. He'd just watch. Watch and wait and think. Rex could do that. Rex could be like Michael Corleone. He could wait. He could watch. But sooner or later, he'd put pen to paper and he'd draw Roberta. And she would know, finally, who really had the power. Brian and Pookie snagged dinner at Little Deli on Eddy Street. Each got a double order of curry shrimp, garlic naan bread, and the restaurant's specialty, a killer chai tea. They wolfed it down, taking the time to talk about sports instead of the case, as they talked the latter into the ground over the past few days. They also avoided talking about Brian's dreams or romantic involvements with Robin Hudson. Pookie was happy, however, to discuss his new sex position, the Chang Bang, a semi-inverted angle that required a bar stool and a hula hoop. Pookie was planning a campaign to get it added to future versions of the Kama Sutra. Dinner completed, they arrived at Galileo just after 5:30 p.m. C.J. Wellman, the assistant principal, led them into Kyle Solar's office and gave them the box of files Solar had prepared for them. Full files on all the Boyko kids, plus Stacy Telling and Chris Wicks. Wellman was thinking ahead and had already added Solar's personal files to the box. All in all, it made for a heaping mound of paper that Brian and Pookie pored over for the next 4 hours. Brian started with the Boyko files, while Pookie looked through the files of Solar, Telling, and Wicks. Trouble wasn't the word for Boyko's reign at Galileo. The real word was assholes. Each of the boys had been caught fighting several times. They'd been disciplined, put into detention, suspended, the works. They'd managed to push the line for being kicked out permanently, but hadn't crossed that line. Brian began with a list of people Boyko had fought. If this was a revenge thing, that was the place to start. From the reports, most of the incidents weren't fights. They were Boyko beating the crap out of someone. Sometimes it was a one-on-one beating, but usually involved one victim and two, three, or all four Boyko gang members at once. And these were just the incidents where they were caught. Brian knew the code of honor still ran through most high schools. You did not tattle. So that meant that these recorded incidents were just the tip of the iceberg. He started with the obvious, looking for names that appeared more than once. There were five. Donald Martin, Jesse Sherrill, Thomas Reed, Rex DePravdichuk, and Gordon Van Tassel. Those five showed a clear pattern. None were in a gang. Boyko were truly predators, picking on the weak, focusing on individuals, careful not to disturb another pack that might be stronger.
"Hey," Pookie said, "I found a name that's in all three files, Tellings, Wicks, and Solar's."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah. This kid looks like he had some serious problems. Let's see here. Screaming fits in Telling's class. Repeated trips to Solar's office for fighting and... oh, yeah. Get this. Wicks physically dragged them to Solar's office because the kid ate a mouse in science class."
"Man, that's sick. He ate one of those formaldehyde jobbies?"
"No, he ate a live mouse. Says here he just picked it up and bit its little head off, legs kicking and everything."
"Nice."
"That got him a week's suspension. Wicks was reprimanded for taking physical action on the kid. Telling gave the kid detention 3 times, said the kid would just start shouting obscenities in French."
"I thought you said Telling taught geography."
"She did. The kid didn't take French either. Says here, they think the kid picked it up on his own, but they don't speak French in his household."
"That sounds like an interesting young lad. What's his name?"
"Rex DePravdichuk. DePravdichuk."
Brian looked at his notes, just to be sure, but he couldn't forget a name like that.
"Pookie, I think I have what the police on the TV news call a person of interest. Rex is also a main target for Boyko. They kicked the crap out of him recently. Just last week, they broke his arm. Rex wouldn't rat out Boyko, but Solar wrote that he knew Boyko was responsible."
"So we've got motive for all 7 of them. Is he a big kid?"
"No, it says here he's all of 5'4", barely over 100 pounds. He's just 13.
Pookie shrugged.
His address listed?
Brian nodded. They put the files back in a neat pile, then left Galileo. Time to visit Rex Depravdichuk's house. Motive. And a solid one at that. The one common thread among all seven cases. Motive was one thing, but what about means and opportunity? Whoever had whacked Solar and Friends had done so with great strength. 100-pound, 13-year-old boy wouldn't have that kind of strength. But that didn't mean shit, really, because there were plenty of big, strong, violent men willing to work on the cheap. Pookie's cell phone rang.
Detective Chang here. Well, hello, Chuck. Is he? That's great. We'll be right over.
Is it Parkmeyer?
Pookie nodded.
Cognizant and alert, apparently. Baker suggested we haul ass because he doesn't know how long it'll last.
All right, cool. Let's go see Parkmeyer right now. When we're done, we can head over to Rex's place. It's a little late, but it's a school night. The kid'll probably still be home.
Hands shook Aggie James awake. He was old, recovering from addiction, and hadn't slept worth a crap in days. But there was no grogginess or wondering where he was, no nice dream that he didn't want to come out of. He knew exactly where he was, and he knew what Hans meant. They meant the little men had come for him. Aggie jerked upright, his threadbare blanket flying off, his hands waving about in total panic, without direction or purpose. He started to scream, but only managed to take a breath in before a hand smacked him in the face, smacked him hard, snapping his head back as he fell to his ass. His face stung like someone had pressed an iron against it. He blinked a few times, feet automatically pushing him back, sliding his ass across the floor until his back hit the white wall. Then he saw a flash of pink fabric with white spots before one hand clamped on the back of his head and the other clamped on his mouth. He smelled baby powder and old lotion. But those sensations vanished as he registered the strength of the hands. In a fraction of a second, he felt their raw power. Hands like a steel skeleton covered with warm flesh. Hands like the Terminator might have. Hands that could snap his neck with no effort at all. Aggie stopped struggling and stared at the old woman who held his head tight. It was Hillary, the woman that brought him food.
"You be quiet,"
Hillary whispered. She wore that pink babushka with the white polka dots covering her thin black hair. She looked so wrinkled, so borderline disheveled, and yet there was no mistaking her strength. She could kill him if she wanted to. He thought about striking out, but she held him so hard he couldn't even move his head, couldn't even open his mouth.
"You be quiet. I can kill you easy peasy. You understand?"
"Mm-hmm,"
Aggie said. It was hard to say yes when you couldn't even nod.
"Good. Tomorrow night, we come for the Mexican."
She turned his head so he could see the Mexican, who was sound asleep.
"I let you go now. You make any trouble for me, I kill you. Understand?"
"Mm-hmm."
"After the four me come for the Mexican, I will come for you. I wish to show you something."
"What do you want to show me?"
"I show you what happens if you do not do what I ask."
Aggie shivered, both in fear and in hope.
"You mean maybe I don't die?"
Hillary nodded.
"Maybe. You do what I say. Maybe you don't die."
Aggie nodded feverishly. He couldn't help it.
"Anything," he whispered. "Anything you want. What do I gotta do?"
She stood and stared down at him.
"You help save the life of a king," she said. "You do this. Maybe you live."
She stood and walked away. Aggie couldn't stop shivering. He'd resigned himself to death, to a brutal end where those freakish little men dragged him out of the cell. What did she call them? For me? But now, her words allowed a sliver of hope to pierce his soul. He gently fingered his jaw. It was already swelling. She'd held his face so hard she'd bruised it. Maybe he could live. Maybe he could get out of this insane dungeon. All he had to do was help save a king. There you go, junkies. That was episode 30. I hope you dug that. We are getting closer to some kind of an endgame. To be honest with you, I'm still not sure how many episodes are left. Could be 40. Could be 30. Could be 7,246. You just don't know. So, a couple things to talk to you about. First of all, it's come to my attention that there are some advanced reader copies of Infected being sold on eBay. An advanced reader copy is what Crown Publishing sends out to the magazines, to the bookstores, to the reviewers. Sends it out to everybody to let them get a review of the book so that the reviews can hit right when the book comes to market in April. It is stamped right on the front of these things. It says, not for resale. These are cheap to produce paperbacks that actually do have the Infected cover, but they're not high quality and they're also uncorrected proof. So this is the version that Crown did back, I'd say it's about 3 months old. There's a lot of mistakes in it. So in short, this is a paperback book. It's low quality. It's unedited. So there's tons of mistakes in it. So it's not very good. These things are being sold on eBay, illegally, mind you, for anywhere from $50 to $130 a copy. Please, for your own sake, you do not want to buy one of these. They don't do you any good. It's an inferior product. It's crap. And at the best price of $50, it's twice as much as a brand new hardcover, an edited hardcover, a professional package. So I don't want to see any of my fans getting screwed. If you see these things out there for sale, don't buy them. You know, don't buy them until after April 1st, unless you got money burning a hole in your pocket and you want them for some obscure reason. Bottom line, it's an inferior product. It's being sold for more, 2 to 4 times as much as the actual nice hardcover. So you do the math. Gotta talk about some sweet editorial coverage I got in Death Ray magazine. Article written by Martin Casserly talking about the phenomenon of Earthcore and podcasting, how it led to a print deal. Now the article also covers my arch nemesis, J.C. Hutchins. So it seems that Hutchins and I are kind of tied at the hip. But it's cool to see both of us get some ink at the same time. The article does not mention that he is my arch nemesis. I'm not sure why that is. I think the reporter, Martin Casserly, just missed the story on that. But the rest of the article is tip-top. That's Death Ray Magazine, and you can search for that, Google it. Or they also have that for sale out at Borders and Barnes & Noble. Go out and pick up a copy. It's like a collector's item. It's kind of neat. And then I will also post a PDF of that article in the show notes at scottsigler.com for episode 13. Now, some of you may seem to think that episode 13 was a day late. Well, let me tell you something. The most important holiday on the entire planet, Super Bowl Sunday, was yesterday. Usually I post on Sunday, but not on Super Bowl Sunday. It is a day of rest. It is a day of food. It is a day of eating. And those of you who aren't from America, maybe you don't understand the significance of this. Those of you who are from America and still don't understand the significance of it, it's the biggest freaking holiday in the world. All season long, I watch football. We come to the Super Bowl. Got to watch a friggin' amazing game. Congratulations to the New York Giants. You guys still couldn't hold a friggin' candle. You couldn't hold the Kraken's jock. So if you like football and you haven't read The Rookie or listened to The Rookie by yours truly, you want to go to patiobooks.com and check that out. It's a science fiction, football, gangster mashup of a story. So that means since Super Bowl Sunday did not exist, I am right on time again. And my streak of 17 years of podcasting every week continues uninterrupted. Yes, I have finished the Infected audiobook. That was the reason that the episodes were calendrically challenged, shall we say, because we know I'm always on time and never miss an episode. But that was what an experience it was to record an entire professional-grade audiobook all in one sitting. Now, I know I burn anywhere from 5 to 8 hours a weekend doing this shit, and it usually kills my weekends, but I never had to sit down and record 88 chapters in one session like I did with the Infected audiobook. As soon as I get done with this episode, I'm walking down to FedEx. I'm FedExing the CDs. I'm happy to have that completed. What a project it was. I don't know if I'll do a whole audiobook myself ever again. I may just record it and have someone else do all the editing because that took a long time. But upgraded my equipment for it, so I think you guys should hear this episode sounded probably the best I've ever sounded. All the effort I put into upgrading for the Infected audiobook, all of that equipment, all that process, all that software change is now at your disposal for Nocturnal. So hopefully, at least from that perspective, it's worth it. Do check out the promos. We got some really interesting stuff after I'm done jibber-jabbering. And of course, thanks for listening, you guys. I will check you out for episode number 14. Maybe in a week, maybe not. Who can say?
In the summer of 2006, Jack Wakes Up, the podcast, was born. In summer 2007, Seth Harwood brought you Jack Palms 2, This Is Life.
It's a cold world and this is life.
And now, in the spring of 2008, Jack Palms 3 and Jack Wakes Up, the print novel, both arrive to rock your world, not once, but two times. Nathan Kane of the Indie Crime Blog says, Jack Wakes Up is an action movie between two covers. And Scott Sigler, Evil Demon, says, Harwood sucker punches crime fiction. It's not a fair fight. Visit SethHarwood.com now to find the latest and greatest in crime fiction as Jack Palms 3 debuts Sunday, February 24th. And on March 16th, Palm Sunday, Jack Wakes Up hits Amazon.com with a vengeance that you have to be a part of to believe. This is your chance to send another shot across the bow of big publishing by telling them it's what you like that really counts. Listen to Jack Palms Crime now at SethHarwood.com, then buy it on March 16th, Palm Sunday, to help push Jack Wakes Up to the top of the Amazon charts. SethHarwood.com, not just another free podcast, it's a way to tell the world what you really like.
In October of 2007, the first ever Buffy the Vampire Slayer audio drama premiered.
We've done this so many times. We just need to get some...
We've done this so many times with Buffy. Without Buffy, we're going to all die horrible deaths.
Buffy Between the Lines attempts to tell the story between the seasons of the television show.
Yeah, not a good idea?
Under the circumstances, it's brilliant.
And the fans have loved it. Here's just a small portion of what the fans have had to say.
Oh my God, this podcast is wonderful. You've given Buffy back to me and to all of us.
Smart, sometimes sad, sometimes funny, but always well written and acted. If audio drama is your cup of tea, you, yes you, need to listen to Buffy Between the Lines.
The dialogue is so good, it's hard to tell that it wasn't written by Joss sometimes.
It wasn't a fanfic years later. It felt like an episode of Buffy during the run. You truly did an amazing job, and I'm so looking forward to the rest of the season. Thank you for keeping the Buffyverse alive.
I'm transported back to Sunnydale on my iPod every time an episode arrives.
Buffy Between the Lines. Find out what happened between the seasons of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. BuffyBetweenTheLines.com.
Do you have 142 minutes of listening time and like science fiction? Then listen to the Jovian Gay Chronicles, available for free on Podiobooks.com. In my 4-part short story collection, I answer the question, what happens when humans cross paths with intelligent aliens that claim to be prophets from God? But don't worry, religion isn't an overbearing theme of the story. Remember, if you're looking for some hard science fiction to listen to, then the Jovian Gay Chronicles is right up your alley. For more information on how to download the free audiobook, visit www.thejoviangate.com.
Out there in the potosphere, there lives a man that heroes fear. A supervillain, strong and foul, with darkened cape and blackened cowl. He spends his free time in his home with mixer board and microphone, and runs his mouth so all can see the benefits of villainy. Horror, fantasy, and fiction are the subjects of his diction. Comics, books, movies, TV, he talks about them all, you see. But secretly, he hopes to win some followers to worship him, an army he can then direct against any hero he can detect. How can you hear his mad remarks? Just listen to Into the Dark. Download, listen, but remain calm at ComputerKingOnline.com.
You have been listening to Nocturnal, written and performed by Scott Sigler. For more information, go to ScottSigler.com.
All music in this podcast provided by Uncrowned off their album Devils and Angels, available now at the iTunes Music Store.